Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Today, we spend the hour analyzing the emergence of the Islamic State, also known as ISIS or ISIL, with two experts. Fred Lawson is with us. He is professor and department head of government at Mills College. He's authored Global Security Watch Syria, Constructing International Relations in the Arab World, and Why Syria Goes to War, 30 Years of Confrontation. Also joining us is Saman Saeed. He is a reader and scholar at the University of Leeds. He's the author of A Fundamental Fear, Eurocentrism and Emergence of Islamism, and A Post-Colonial People, South Asians in Britain. Welcome to the two of you. It's great to have you here on the Scholar Circle. Fred Lawson, let's start with you. And Syria, as you pointed out in your writing, Syria's civil war, now going into its fourth year, is sort of mutating. How would you describe the dynamics now in Syria?
Probably the most important thing that's taking place is that the conflict is taking on a dimension that entails communal ties, communal identities, more than ever before. Lines are polarizing along sectarian lines or along linguistic lines in important ways. We see this most evidently in the crucial role that the various Islamist movements are playing. The Islamist movements are the vanguard of the fighters on the ground. They're setting the agenda for the conflict in general. And several of these Islamist groups have started to attack minority communities inside Syria. And so the minority communities inside Syria have taken up arms. They've done their best to defend themselves in the face of the Assistance Front, which is usually called Jabhat al-Nusra, or in the face of this Islamic State organization. The one communal group that has taken up arms and has gone the farthest toward becoming a player in its own right is the Kurdish community in Syria. And so a crucial fault line in Syria right at the moment is this armed struggle between the radical Islamists on one hand and the Kurdish militias on the other.
I think the last time we had you on was pre-Islamic State, what people call ISIS or ISIL. We've got the three groups that you mentioned, but as I recall from your work, it's much more complex than that. How many groups are we really talking about?
Some scholars estimate that there may be a couple of thousand separate armed militias on the ground in Syria. But if we wanted to talk about some important ways of dividing this up, one way to divide things up might be Islamist groups whose major focus is changing society inside Syria, dealing with Syria as the focus of the program and the platform of the organization. Let's call these perhaps nationalist Islamist groups. And the national Islamist groups can be exemplified by something like the battalions of the free in Syria, or some of the groups inside the Syrian Revolutionaries Front. And their primary objective is to deal with the regime inside the country and to perhaps set up a new kind of social order, but inside Syria. A second kind of group has its primary focus in the global arena and is trying to carry out a global struggle to protect Muslims and perhaps to roll back threats from the West or roll back threats from Christians around the world. The first of those groups in Syria was a group with close ties to al-Qaeda, and it's this group called the Assistance Front, or called Jabhat al-Nusra. And the Assistance Front carried out hit-and-run attacks like suicide bombings and like terrorist operations, all during 2012. But now the Assistance Front has been superseded, has been overtaken by a group that originated in Iraq and that set out to merge with the Assistance Front, but the merger did not take. And it's this third group, this different group, called the Islamic State. The crucial question is to see how different the platform of the Islamic State is from the platform of the Assistance Front. And I look forward to hearing other people's views on this, but on the whole, as I see it, the Islamic State's project is not so much global jihad as it is to carve out a community of Muslims irrespective of existing national boundaries. So it's not a project that is contained inside the national boundaries of Syria, but I don't think it's a global project either. It's a project to create a new kind of political community, a new kind of political community that spills over existing borders, and that's the project that we link with the Islamic State.
So kind of a pan-geography kind of approach.
I think so. And certainly pan across the border between Syria and Iraq, certainly across the border between Syria and Lebanon, maybe even across the border into Saudi Arabia. A couple of weeks ago, the leader of Islamic State announced that it was probably time to bring the struggle to Saudi Arabia as well.
Dr. Salman Saeed, would you agree with this assessment?
In many ways, the difference may be of emphasis. I can see why Fred's making a distinction between groups which are much more focused on the existing nation states and those who want to transcend that. But I would say two things. Firstly, I think globalization has made that distinction less emphatic than it used to be traditionally. So I don't see it in so sharp terms. I think nearly most Islamist groups of one kind or another have a certain kind of family resemblance with each other around the idea that the prevailing international order and its regional components is something that needs to be reformed. They may disagree about the manner of that reform, the manner of transcending it, but I don't think there is a strong commitment to maintaining those boundaries. But I think it's quite right, certainly with ISIS and their declaration of the caliphate, it kind of makes a virtue of the fact that they have actually controlled territory which transcends two existing states, Iraq and Syria. One of the reasons they were able to call themselves a caliphate, apart from their dispute with Al-Qaeda, was to make a virtue of the fact that they don't fit into the prevailing political geography. I think the second thing is that the proliferation of groups in Syria and in Iraq, etc., I think we need to give it a much more comparative dimension. And really, what we're seeing is the emergence of warlordism in the Middle East. And warlordism happens when these armed groups appear, when you have state collapse. And in that sense, there's a great deal of similarity, a structural similarity between what we're seeing in Syria and Iraq than to what we've seen in places like parts of Central Africa, around Congo, for example, or in bits of South America, and even to some extent, you know, in Central America, where a state is unable to control and regulate and maintain its monopoly of violence, the possibility of these armed groups proliferates. And I think that is one of the main structural factors. Both the Iraqi state and the Syrian state have collapsed. And I would say that most of the Middle Eastern states, which were configured during the Cold War to deal with mainly internal security through the use of security and police and torture rather than trying to win legitimacy, are finding this new terrain really, really difficult to manage. And you're seeing their weakening and unraveling all around them. And I don't think we've seen the end of this process yet.
Salman Saeed, you also have written that these groups, particularly the more radical Islamists, have emerged from this lack of legitimacy among governments. But it's not just the inability to contain violence within the state, but it sounds like that they also failed to really allow people to have meaningful lives and meaningfully participate politically. Could you help us understand this aspect?
I think if you think about most of these states, like Saddam's Iraq, the Ba'ath state in Syria, Mubarak's Egypt, and al-Sisi's Egypt, they're quite odd in one way. They're most historically, the state guaranteed the protection of the people, and in return, it got loyalty from the people. This has been the kind of pattern of state formations. Now, the Cold War actually made the guarantee of the state's integrity dependent on external factors. Basically, the superpowers underwrote the boundaries of those states. That's why during the Cold War, we had very little variation in these boundaries. And the states kind of knew that external security, they were safe. They were not going to be invaded. As a consequence, I would argue, they didn't need internal resources to maintain themselves. Therefore, the people were not, they didn't need taxes necessarily. And in most of these cases, they were rentier states. They didn't need the loyalty of the people because they didn't depend on them for those, their security. Thus, the people were mainly the source of threat. And all of these states were configured mainly for dealing with internal threats. Now, what's happened with the end of the Cold War and the collapse in Iraq with the Ba'athist regime is they have not been able to adapt to in an environment, an international environment, which is far more threatening militarily. They haven't got the means to resist foreign intervention. To do that, they require the ability to generate their own resources. So it's not just a question of meaningful life, in a sense. People were actually more or less irrelevant for most of these states for most of the time. They didn't have any reason to be involved in the political process because they didn't need them. And we should remember also in the history of the development of the state in Europe, North America, it wasn't that it was leaders were wise and they just gave people their rights. People's rights emerged as part of a process of bargaining and struggle in which the rulers needed the people to fight their wars and pay their taxes. And in return, the people were saying, well, we want to have a say in the decisions you make. And that kind of bargain was never really sustained in the post-Ottoman states in the Middle East.
Fred Lawson, what would you say to that?
Yes, and I think what Salman says is absolutely crucial and right on target. I might go one tiny step farther to say that the old authoritarian regimes in Egypt and in Iraq and Syria did their very best to block citizens from having any initiative or taking any public role in day-to-day politics. And so one of the things that looks attractive to the assistance front, or looks attractive even to the Islamic State, is that the Islamic State has come in to cities and has made a kind of appeal to the local population, that the local population should help the assistance front to enforce order, or the assistance front should look to the citizenry to report people who are not behaving in a moral way. And people in these peripheral cities that have either been left behind or been suppressed during the Ba'athi era in Syria find that they're being encouraged to be a little bit active in public, or at least I should say the mainstream Sunni populations in these cities are being encouraged to play a part in public life. And I think that's part of the reason why populations have not immediately mobilized to resist or to try to push the radical Islamists out.
I think Fred's absolutely right. But I think one of the issues also is this: organizing resistance requires a skill set. It's not something people can just do very easily. And in both this Syrian and the Iraqi case, you've had almost the trauma of 30 years of Ba'athist rule. And I think one of the factors behind the horrific violence the Islamic State uses is that there's a presence of a large Ba'athist, ex-Ba'athist contingent. And the thing is, the Ba'athist repertoire, especially the Iraqi Ba'athist repertoire, though I don't think the Syrian are that different, but perhaps less bombastic or less ostentatious, was simply to confuse governance with violence. With governance was simply about giving orders and threatening people. There was no attempt to win hearts and minds. And the state was basically based, more or less, in large measure, on the cultivation of fear as the main instrument of winning and maintaining order. And as a consequence, they have very little understanding of even how to try and build a legitimacy. And I think what is interesting is that because of the armed groups are actually quite weak, they require some modicum of support from the people they exercise the rule over to be able to maintain it. And this is where I think there are enough cracks that appear that there is opening that Fred is talking about, of some kind of public life or public agency in very circumspect means, but is far better in one regard, that they're dealing with entities which are far weaker than the Ba'athist states were in their full pomp.
And things really are quite remarkable. In the central Syrian city of Raqqa, this provincial capital that is now the center of the Islamic State, that's the largest urban area, oh, well, except for Mosul in Iraq, that Islamic State controls. I mean, at first, the radical Islamists came into the city, pushed out the Free Syrian Army, and ended a lot of the corruption and a lot of the chaos that was present when the Free Syrian Army was in control of the place. And parts of the population thought that this was a step forward to end the corruption. Now things have gone one farther step, but at least in the beginning, some of this radical Islamist order looked better than the chaos that was there before.
So then let's tie this in, first of all, to some of the regional governments that you've both talked about, but also this sort of railing against the West as well. It sounds like there's an attraction partly because of the corruption, and then the West gets criticized also for the role it's played. Salman Saeed?
One of the pictures that we have is somehow the West is some sort of innocent bystander, but a sort of intermittent visitor to the region. It doesn't look like that, certainly from the Islamist group's point of view, and I would argue wider than that. The West has been involved in constructing the region as it is since the demise of the Ottomans. And there have been various kinds of strategies which have been tried to maintain order, you know, through the kind of regional Nixon doctrine, through the Carter doctrine, to, you know, where we are now. And the corruption, the authoritarianism, they are actually linked with Western support or intervention. And I think here, Egypt is a pragmatic case. If you remember, the whole narrative around the invasion of Iraq was that this ultimately began the process of the democratization of the Middle East. And what you had in Egypt, with the overthrow of Mubarak, was a process of the first kind of freely elected government. When that was overthrown by el-Sisi, with hardly a murmur, I think that, in a way you could argue, helped consolidate the possibility of something like ISIS. Because it became clearer that when Western governments talk about democracy, they actually mean regimes which are going to be supportive of them, not necessarily supportive of their peoples, or not necessarily democratic in any particular sense. Similar thing happened when the West Bank and Palestine Hamas was elected by elections by which were all intents and purposes considered to be more or less free and legitimate. What was the reaction of the European Union and the United States? To cut off aid to the Palestinians, that if you vote for Hamas, we will not provide you with aid. And again, it looked like that what was at stake here wasn't so much democracy, but really whether the regimes were compliant with Western interests. And the final thing is this: who is touted as one of the best, strongest allies, a force for moderation? The absolute monarchies of the Gulf and, in principle, Saudi Arabia. And as long as that convergence between Saudi interest and Western interest remain, it is very difficult to argue that the West in the region has a role of democratization. Part of the problem is this, that I think Western publics assume, because mainly based on the history of Europe in the 1930s onwards, that Western power, United States power, has always been at the servant of people's aspirations. This may be true to some extent in Eastern Europe and Europe under Nazi occupation. The experience of regions outside Europe, in places like Southeast Asia, South America, Central America, parts of Africa, is not the same. Their experiences nearly always, not exclusively, but nearly always, Western power has been supportive of authoritarian, dictatorial regimes which have been against their people. Now, because the role of the West is read through the European experience, that dark side completely gets left out of the equation. And as a result, you have this idea that Western powers are considered to be these honest brokers minding their own business, trying to do the best for everyone, and these people are either so kind of pathologically inclined to hate the West for no reason that they just don't have any sensible engagement with the West. And I don't think that's particularly helpful or actually particularly coherent view of, and I think part of the problem is this kind of disconnect now between the idea of the West as self-image as a force for liberation and democratization and emancipation, and the experience of others as the Western, as one of the main blockers of popular emancipation.
Fred Lawson, I want to bring you back in. Given these dynamics, where is the funding for these groups like the Islamic State, ISIS or ISIL, coming from? I understand a lot of it is coming from the Saudis and also from Qataris.
Let me say something first about the dynamics that Salman was talking about that have put Turkey in an almost impossible situation, because Turkey now finds itself completely pulled by the West to take a hard line against the Islamic State, to do everything it can to join the coalition led by France and the United States. But on the other hand, Turkey has strategic interests of its own. Turkey is every bit as worried about an armed Kurdish national movement as it is worried about armed Islamists. The Turkish government, maybe a year ago, finally decided to put the assistance front, Jabhat al-Nusra, on the list of terrorist organizations. But unless it happened this morning, the Turks have still not put the Islamic State on Turkey's list of terrorist organizations. So Turkey's trying really hard to juggle its own regional strategic interests, but the United States and France are twisting Turkey's arm to do things that might be in the West's general interests. And how Turkey is going to solve this doesn't look clear to me, because lots of domestic discontent against the Turkish government's hesitance, against the Turkish government's vacillation with regard to the militant Islamists in Syria, seems to be bubbling up. It's probably true that in the beginning there was support for the Assistance Front and support for Islamic State from the rich Arab Gulf states. Some of that support may not have been from the state governments themselves, may have been from rich private individuals and rich private organizations in the Arab Gulf states. And those linkages seem murky to me. Sitting in California, I really cannot trace out the links of financing some of those groups. But what does seem to be true is that after some initial seed money went in, the Islamic State proved to have quite a bit of tactical genius at seizing resources, not just the oil wells, but seizing grain supplies and seizing electrical power stations. The Islamic State has done a quite spectacular job of raising money to keep itself going. And faced with an organization like that, it's a little hard to know where to intervene to cut that funding, because Islamic State is almost to the point that it's self-sustaining. Now, I did see on the news that the Syrian Armed Forces has regained control of one of the biggest Syrian oil fields. So maybe the oil resources will start to be scaled back. The oil money flowing through Islamic State hand will get scaled back. But Islamic State has sunk its roots pretty deeply into northwestern Iraq and northeastern Syria.
Salman Saeed?
Well, I just want to go back to what Fred said, and he's quite right. But one thing we have to remember, if you think about the wars in Angola, which carried on for decades, they were basically financed through diamond smuggling, through other kinds of extraction of resources, through taxation, etc., of various kinds. So in a way, the funding issue is actually less important now than perhaps it used to be. But it's not just the funding. I think one of the main issues is this. In the initial moments of the Syrian civil war, Syrian unrest, the front, the opposition, was divided along the lines between those who opposed the Ba'athist regime and those who supported it. Now, Saudis have played a major part in trying to rearticulate that conflict into those sectarian lines, turning it into a Shia-Sunni conflict. Partly they've done this as a way of depoliticizing the conflict, because ultimately what the Saudis are concerned about is maintaining their own authority and their own regime. And they see any kind of overthrow of the authoritarian order is actually quite threatening to them, because they know that their own legitimacy is at stake here. So one way of depoliticizing the conflict is to try and make it out a conflict about sectarian differences rather than principles of governance. And they've had great success in this. Now, I don't want to say that they were the only ones doing this, but they certainly were quite supportive of trying to read the conflict through a sectarian lens. And they have been successful in allowing that conflict to be represented like that. And And once you start that process, then those on the ground start responding to that kind of framing. And as a consequence, the conflict then becomes almost endemic. It becomes something that cannot be resolved that easily. And the idea of any kind of principles of governance, of distribution of power or resources or whatever, or justice, become lost through this kind of attempt to try and have a conflict simply on the basis of that what you are against is the very essence of who the others are. And I think this sectarianization of political conflict is something that happens repeatedly in outside Western areas, because conflict is always represented as having a non-political element to it. We saw that again. Fred made a very interesting point about how difficult the situation is for the Turkish government. And during the coverage of the assault ISIS was making in Kobani, there was a lot of things, why don't the Turks intervene? Leaving aside, the Turks are supposed to be intervening to support groups who were actually still involved in kind of armed and forced engagement against the Turks. Plus, leaving aside, that the overwhelming majority of the Turkish population were not in favor of a Turkish intervention at that time. So I think that this was considered to be discounted, and the entire Turkish non-action was read as simply manifesting anti-Kurdish sentiments. And again, this is a very, very complex situation. It doesn't help that we end up reading conflicts in Middle East and parts of Africa and Asia involving ethnic hatreds, religious hatreds, which are considered to be primordial rather than specific political issues, which are actually the triggering point for those conflicts.
That's really important to bring out. When we come back, we continue to analyze the rise of the Islamic State and what it means. Stay tuned. Hey, dunya, ye dunya badi gol hai. Hey, dunya, hai isme kitne chhol. Galiyo, galiyo, chappa, chappa, ablam, chappalam, laare, lappa, toba, toba. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the rise of the Islamic State, the dynamics in the Middle East, and the developments between the Middle East and the West. Fred Lawson, I'd like you to say where you see this going, and what, if you could sort of assess this, like, what would the wise thing to do be?
Well, I'm sitting here trying to process Salman's extraordinarily interesting notion of how depoliticization processes are working here. It reminds me that perhaps 18 months ago, there were pretty reliable reports that lots of the activists in the Islamic State units, and sometimes in the Assistance Front units too, were Saudis. They came to Syria, there were people speaking Saudi dialect and so on. But as time has gone by far the dominant people in the ranks of Islamic State seem to be Chechens and Dagestanis and people from Azerbaijan, the same kind of people that ended up going to Afghanistan to fight against the Red Army. But the point is, they're not Arabs. They don't really have a stake in regional conflicts. And in some respects, then, they would not be politicized, in a sense, and Saudi Arabia might well see Islamic State made up of North Caucasus fighters as something that was a tool that would then not threaten Saudi Arabia. And that's the very delicate game Saudi Arabia is playing here, how to encourage a radical Islamist movement that does not turn around and attack the kingdom.
Salman Saeed?
I think that's a very interesting point. I mean, look, the problem is this. The radical Islamist movements are actually anti-Saudi in the sense that it cannot be supporters of the Saudi regime for all kinds of reasons. But the Saudis have been trying to basically ride this tiger. And I think this is why one of the antipathies that the Saudis have to the Iranian regime after the revolution is precisely around this issue. I mean, again, it's presented as this ancient hatred between the Arabs and the Iranians and the Persians, which is really kind of Arab nonsense in a way. But it's exactly what I think Fred is saying. I suppose an example would be the use of Hessian soldiers by the British, that you actually thought that they would not have any kind of interest, that they could tie them down, and they could be used without being recuperated into the revolutionary struggle. And the idea is this, that if you can get these people from Chechnya, all these, they have no roots in the region, they have no kind of capacity to actually engage with the population. So in a sense, it's almost a kind of latter-day Mamelukes army which has been created. The difficulty is, and this is what is interesting, and I don't know the answers to this, is that only works if you have a very kind of static idea of how transformations can take. And what has been shown is that the process of the struggle itself, the war itself, and the entire kind of Islamist narrative may be sufficient to weaken those kind of links so that these people do start having a particular kind of commitment. And it's very interesting that we've had reports on publicly how fighters from Britain and France have been burning their passports, like they're not going anywhere. And the narrative of the Islamists has generally been that they don't have a homeland as such. There's no national space for them. They are part of the Ummah itself. So they don't see national boundaries as being really important. Now, the real key issue is this, whether they have the skills to become part of civil society in those regions so that they become part of it rather than simply a kind of a group of people floating over it. And I think that's what's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. But the real issue is this, that Islamists traditionally, up till this war, had tended to be post-Mazhab-Mazbi, that they haven't really been emphasizing their sectarian ideology. I mean, in a sense, Khomeini was quite interesting in this. Similarly, for example, Sayyid Qutb, if you look at his writing, they were not really focused on Shia-Sunni differences as being key or meaningful. Now what's happening is that the Islamists, as part of that kind of post-Mazhabi Islam, are actually facing a kind of the sectarian challenge. And if the Islamists are ever to have any kind of progressive, and I use that word loosely, in a sense of progressive, in a sense of reforming possibility, they would have to be something that transcends those sectarian divides, those national divides, those ethnic divides. If they simply become recuperated as basically another armed mercenary band, then I don't see things actually getting much better than this.
Well, it sure looks like Islamic State is experimenting, is pushing in one direction, see how it goes, and then pushes the other direction. For a while, it looked like Islamic State was carrying out a kind of ethnic cleansing. And in the territories that it took over, ethnic state just plain invited the Kurds or the Christians or the Ismailis to leave.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
anyone who was too slow was butchered. But it does seem that in some other cities, or perhaps at some other moments, Islamic State is going all the way back to an early Muslim tradition of tolerance for minority communities, so long as they did not try to play a role in public life, and so long as they paid a discriminatory tax in money. And so I think Islamic State sort of finds itself in charge of Raqqa, and maybe in charge of Mosul as well, and is the leadership sort of trying to figure out how to run this place, because it's trying to run this place with very few fighters. I was really struck the other day, the situation looks a little bit to me like the British in India during the imperial era. Britain tried to run all of India with a couple of thousand troops, and Islamic State is trying to run this huge area between Iraq and Syria with probably only a couple of thousand troops. It can't be everywhere, so they rule through terror, through scaring people to death to do anything that would resist or mobilize against Islamic State. And they seem to rule, too, by moving quickly back and forth all over the place, catching any potential adversary off guard. I was struck that there was an attack launched on a Ramadi in Iraq. So moving the battle to some other area is a way to keep opposition off guard. But the Islamic State really does not have many cadres to try to exercise any sort of authority in the area that it nominally controls.
This is a very, very important point, Fred, and I think people forget this when they talk about the threat of the Islamic State. Islamic State is very thin on the ground. I mean, the British managed to rule India with a couple of 100,000 troops, plus the active support of many other Indian political centers. And that was crucial for them. And they were also taking over ongoing imperial structure, the Mughal Empire. So they had many kinds of channels and infrastructure of rule and regulation. Now, what is happening for the Islamic State is that they're trying to rule without a developed cadre, because unlike, let's say, the Communist Party and the kind of other national liberation movements, they haven't been in training for years and years planning for this moment, which I think is one of the biggest contrasts between the national liberation movements and the Islamic State. And they're ruling over a territory which doesn't have any kind of regional identity right now, which doesn't have kind of infrastructure of control in place, because the state just has imploded in those places there. And they are actually, they remind me much more of the situation the Taliban faced when they took over Afghanistan for the first time, where they basically had to make pacts, almost a kind of a federated structure, because they were actually making pacts with lots of armed groups, which the armed groups were happy to do so because the Taliban offered some degree of order, but also some degree of violence. Of course, what was interesting about the Taliban, that they were managed to exercise control over 90% of Afghanistan and the opium production, etc. But when the Americans came, all those federated groups suddenly saw, well, actually, the American military power is much stronger, and they basically deserted in their droves. Now, I think, in a way, that was one kind of model, where you have these groups that you can use rule by proxy, almost kind of a federated rule. And it'll be interesting to see that these kind of different developments show that actually, I imagine that the Islamic State is not a cohesive unit. I think those tensions within it are more likely to come out. And the other thing is that the reason why the Islamic State has been able to make these great strides in the control of the area is due not to its strength, but to the weakness of those around it. At the most estimates of the Islamic State is that they have got 60,000 fighters. This is not sufficient to guarantee control over a region that size. If they ever faced a competent army, one doesn't feel that they would be able to make these kinds of headways. And in fact, what happened in Kobani, where the Kurdish resistance was able to organize themselves, remember the town was about to fall, and it didn't. So I think one of the problems is that, and I think this is one of the reasons why they show their violence, because the violence is a sign of their weakness, not a sign of their strength. And again, it's very, very similar to things like Shining Path in Peru or the FRAC or these guerrillas. They exist as parasitic organisms on the body of failed states. If the states are able to be rejuvenated and bring about kind of centralized, competent rule, then their days are actually numbered, unless they're able to offer something more than terror and fear. And it's not clear at this point which direction Islamic State will go.
Which I think is the segue to the question we were asked a little bit ago. I think it would help enormously groups that are opposed to the Islamic State if some sort of coherent alternative project were actually adopted. I still find it remarkable that 4 years in to the civil war, I have no idea what the Syrian National Coalition has in mind.
Absolutely.
As a future for the Syrian state. Now, there was a document that talked about elections and a document that talked about a constitution, I think. There may even be a draft constitution. But that's such a long way away from what would have to be done tomorrow or what would have to be done today. There's no real platform that alternative groups can bring. No doubt the people of Raqqa and the people of Mosul are not terribly pleased with the situation they find themselves in now, but if there's no other choice, if there's no other alternative arrangement that's in front of them, they don't really have any incentive to take action, to throw the Islamic State out.
And I think when you're asking people to take arms or risk their lives to overthrow violent authorities, you need to give them some reason for doing so. And the absence of an alternative project is a failure which is not just of leadership, but I think is a broader intellectual failure, that the resistance to the Ba'athist regime has not been able to name the future that it wants to move towards.
And the model of Iraq is sure not very inspiring.
No, exactly.
Because after the Ba'athi order came al-Maliki, who put together a very structured, discriminatory, almost authoritarian system of his own. And so people in Syria may look and say, boy, we don't want that kind of post-Ba'athi order.
Well, given all of these dynamics, what in the face of all of this should the U.S. foreign policy look like? It sounds like it's doing everything wrong, perhaps. Salman Saeed?
Well, it depends what you mean it's doing everything wrong. Wrong for who? It's only doing things wrong for the people in the region, but it's not necessarily clear that it's doing things wrong for its own interests. And I think we need to keep that in mind, that the interests of the United States may not be and cannot always be the interests of the people of the region. And in that sense, you may have to make different kinds of choices. I think if there is a kind of overarching goal in the United States foreign policy, and I believe it is, perhaps not fully articulated, I think they don't want to see, for example, the Saudi regime to be toppled. They do not want that. I think they would prefer generally to deal with authoritarian regimes who are compliant with there and they're easy to deal with than regimes which may have democratic semblance but are much more unwieldy. So in a sense, there's two choices here being made. Either we think that the kind of expansion of the Islamist projects, movements, which have now been going on, I would say at least in its most active form, for at least 50-odd years now, either people still believe that this is something that will disappear and all we have to do is stand fast, or this is a kind of a transformation, rather like the emergence of nationalism in Europe, which actually cannot be stopped by any one particular form of statecraft. And in that sense, prudent statecraft would require that you learn to surf and ride the waves of history rather than acting like King Canute and rolling it back. So I think that's the first choice. Can the United States allow Islamist groups which embody at some level the idea that Muslims should be able to write their own history to be in a position to do so? Or can they not? And without that kind of agreement or consensus, I think American policy is going to be directly opposed to the aspirations of many people in the region to be in control of their lives.
Fred Lawson, would you agree?
I do, and I think the United States would do well to recalibrate its objectives, to recalibrate its expectations about the region. We all know what the United States wants, I think. The United States, both in the Bush years and the Obama years, wanted Middle Eastern governments that would reflect the will of the local people and that the will of those local people would be completely parallel with, completely congruent with American interests. The United States still thinks that any right-thinking people around the world will set up governments the way we do, will have an economic organization the way we do, will watch Hollywood movies the way we do, and so on. And any sense that if a society is left to its own devices, it might go off in a different direction, leaves the United States at sixes and sevens. It doesn't quite know how to deal with a country like that. And in the good old days of American hegemony in the 1960s and 70s, most countries would fall in line. Most countries saw that there wasn't any real advantage to resisting American hegemony. But we may be in a moment now, with China around, with Europe around, in which countries that elect their own governments might decide to go off on a tangent to reflect their own interests. And the United States hasn't really grappled with that situation.
You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the rise of the Islamic State, the dynamics in the Middle East, and the developments between the Middle East and the West. Salman Saeed?
I think one of the things we have to recognize is the issue of democracy and its relationship to diversity. You cannot believe in any meaningful sense in democracy if you do not believe in a meaningful sense in diversity. And this diversity has to be at a global level. And I think Fred is actually absolutely right. The point about elections is not to allow the inner Californian to come out or the inner American to come out. It's simply to allow people to choose their own destiny. And people being people, they will choose sometimes differently or sometimes, you know, congruently. But if you say you believe in democracy, it seems to me you have to then accept that you have to believe in diversity and vice versa. One of the kind of hubris of the post-war era was that there was a sense in which there was a belief that westernization would be the future of the world. And in fact, an Americanization was the vanguard of this process of westernization. And we've heard people talking about Coca-Cola, Hollywood, etc. Watching Hollywood, drinking Coca-Cola would somehow make you American and align your interests with American interests. This is not going to happen. Drinking Coca-Cola doesn't make you American. You can watch Hollywood films without actually aspiring to or accepting American narratives of their place in history, for example. So the issue really is this: how much blood and treasure will the American governments try and expend to try and regulate the diversity of the planet? Because this is what we're dealing with on a planetary scale now. And it seems to me that if the United States does not face existential threat from these groups in the way that you could argue it faced from the Soviet Union. It faces something else, though. It faces the possibility of imagining a future in which the United States and the West is simply one among many other centers of not necessarily power or wealth, but certainly of templates and models for how humans can live. And that, I would argue, is not necessarily a bad thing. If you can only imagine that the good life and the sense of truth and justice can only come from one historical tradition, and rather one particular reading of a historical tradition, then you are condemning everyone else to either forget their own history and their past and who they are, but more importantly, you're forgetting that in fact the universal good can be generated from any kind of regional complexes. You don't need to go through this detour of Western history trying to imitate that to get a good life. I mean, I think that project, what I call Kemalism, was really about that. If you wanted to be successful, you had to follow the model of what happened in Europe, what happened in the United States. I think that is a really important part of what this problem is about. It is a part about trying to deal with diversity in a way which makes sense, or by linking it to democracy itself. Without that, you will be constantly repeating these kinds of interventions without becoming any more successful in them. We are now in the second decade of the war on terror, and some people are talking about this war as a multi-generational struggle. It is not clear to me that the idea of a perpetual war will actually achieve anything that the United States hopes to achieve, and I say United States, certain factions within the United States, of having a planet which is simply a reflection of its own self. And I think that narcissism has to be broken for the good of the world, but also the good of the American people themselves.
Fred Lawson.
Oh, and we should certainly remember that even in Syria, even today, there are political figures that are fighting hard for the same kind of vision of tolerance to lie at the heart of democracy, tolerance and notions of respect for alternative views and so on. The intrepid band of civil rights activists that's been fighting against the regime inside Damascus, many of them tied up with the National Coalition of Democratic Forces in Damascus, and how the United States could interact with these groups poses a real dilemma, because these groups very much see the importance of keeping their distance from Washington. Because the minute they look like they're cooperating with the United States, they'll be tarred as being foreign agents. And so the real dilemma, the real juggling act for the Obama administration is how to provide encouragement or have other actors give encouragement to the very few liberal organizations and liberal actors inside Syria, but not doing it directly. Dealing directly with these groups would be the kiss of death. And the United States then really finds itself flat-footed in whom to back.
If you were advising President Obama, you would say what to him?
The first thing that I might say is that I have been surprised by how successful the airstrikes around Kobani seem to have been. I would have predicted that the airstrikes would have created collateral damage, would have hurt civilians, would have reinvigorated the Islamic State. But American technology, French technology, seems to be precise enough that some of that collateral damage has gone away. But now, I might well say that it's a moment to let things on the ground sort themselves out, whether the United States has a meaningful role in shaping and manipulating events on the ground is not clear to me at all.
You know, it's interesting you'd say that, as I've heard in some media programs, a lot of blame placed on the Obama administration for not getting involved in Syria in a more meaningful way as being one of the reasons that the Islamic State or ISIS has emerged in the power that it has. It sounds like you're saying that's not true at all.
Well, certainly if we look at Iraq in 2004-2005, the history points exactly the opposite way. The progenitor of the Islamic State took shape in active opposition to American intervention in the region. And we can trace a direct line from the groups that fought against the United States to the people who are in charge of Mosul and Raqqa today. And these groups may well get reinvigorated. They may find that their mission is reaffirmed if there's active U.S. intervention, if the U.S. allows these groups to their own devices, there's at least a chance that they will wither on the vine, that some other forces will mobilize to fight them. That seems pretty cold-hearted, and it seems very much against the grain of the United States to allow horrible situations to go on without the United States trying to step in. But there may be other actors. If the United States keeps its distance, Russia and Iran certainly have interests in this conflict and might well mobilize to deal with things.
I would hate to trust Russia and Iran to enhance the well-being of innocent people. I hate to say that from here, but Salman Saeed, what do you think?
No, I think I would actually agree to one extent. I think if you were serious about an ideal best solution, I think it would be a regional solution in which it would require a convergence between Turkey and Iran. And the fact that you have a mistrust of Iran for doing anything active is quite interesting for lots of reasons, because I think that displays a certain kind of attitude that the Americans have about the Islamic Republic and Iran. You know, after for 30 years describing it as this terrorist state, this monstrous place, etc., etc. So in a sense, that it's not something, an advice that one I could give about any president of America, or the advice would be taken. I think, look, the real issue is this. It seems to me there is a clear attempt to try and say that we have to reform Muslims, Islam, the Middle East, etc. And part of that attempt is often couched in this language: what we need to find is a moderate Muslim. And the most famous thing is that, you know, the regular anointment of some Muslim as the Martin Luther of Islam, who will bring about the Reformation. What I find stunning about these narratives is that there is no Muslim pope for Martin Luther or Muslim Martin Luther to rail against. And this kind of use of European history and American history to try and read back what is happening in the region is flawed. It's flawed because, A, the completely different kind of historical processes are happening, which may have some similarities, but they can't simply be just imposed upon one from the other. But secondly, it's also a kind of a misreading of a certain kind of fundamental humanity. I think one of the things that always strikes people outside of the United States is if you think about the way the United States celebrates its anti-colonial struggle against the British, who by all intents were probably not the worst or the most brutal of dictatorships, but the United States was willing to fight a war for 8 years to free itself from British rule. Why do they think that this aspiration for freedom is something that will be lacking in other people? And in a way, I think this is what I said at the beginning. As long as the United States sees itself as the liberator of European people and the guardian of the Japanese from Soviet rule, and completely disavows its role in the rest of the world, where it has not been a liberator, I think it's not going to understand why is it the suspicion, why it's held with such great suspicion. Nor will it have much positive solutions to offer in the region. Right now, and I think Fred is right, if you were serious about what was happening in the region, the United States could have done many things, including, for example, showing with great consistency and clarity that it opposed the overthrow of a democratically elected government in Morrissey. However bad it may be, they could have asked for elections, but they wouldn't have asked for elections because they knew the Muslim Brotherhood would win. So the point is this, that the United States has shown itself not to be a honest broker repeatedly. And this is why the Israel-Palestine conflict is actually quite interesting, not because all the radicalism and all the issues that revolve around it, but it continuously displays the partiality of American support. The hypocrisy when America continually talks about the Iranian nuclear threat without saying a word about the second strike capability that Israel has and has had through the acquiescence and consent of Western powers. So from a point of view of what the United States' real interests are, what it has done in the region, it remains completely ignorant, and this is an ignorance that is structural. And as a consequence, its ability to intervene is, I would suggest to you, quite stymied. When the Iraq would be invaded, there was an opportunity to have a process in Iraq of something like they did in South Africa of truth and reconciliation. I think the American occupation prevented that radically. Even Saddam's trial was a travesty. He was indicted for killing only 128 people, where the, because there was no desire to look at the wider support that the United States was involved in supporting the Ba'athist regime. There was no chance for Iraqi society to heal its own wounds of the violence and the treachery and the betrayals that are symptomatic of life under authoritarian regime.
Thank you both so much, Saman Saeed and Fred Lawson. What a pleasure to have you both with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Yes, how wonderful. Thank you.
Fred Lawson is professor and department head of government at Mills College. He's authored Global Security Watch Syria, Constructing International Relations in the Arab World, and Why Syria Goes to War, 30 Years of Confrontation. Saman Saeed is a reader and scholar at the University of Leeds. He's the author of A Fundamental Fear, Eurocentrism and Emergence of Islamism, and A Post-Colonial People, South Asians in Britain. And that is it for this week's edition of the Scholar Circle. Many thanks to everybody who makes this show possible, Ankina Ghassan, Melissa Chiprin, Khwatemok Aleman, and our webmaster, Sad Dongre. Most of all, thank you for listening. Please be sure to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter at @Armudian. If you missed a part of the show, you can always get them from the KPFK archives or from our own archives, scholarcircle.org. We'll see you next week.